Welcome to Carrying Wayward, a supernatural podcast for fans who aren't ready to let go and newcomers to the series who are ready to jump in. I'm Marie Vigouroux.
And I'm Drew Schulman. In this episode, we're diving into Supernatural, Season 7, Episode 23, the season finale, Survival of the Fittest. Let's get this show on the road.
So before we start today, we do have an announcement, and it's that I will be at the Supernatural Convention in New Jersey this May. If you're going, and if you see me, please come say hi, okay? Like, I will be in full social mode, so don't think that you're going to be bothering me. I want to meet everybody who is there and who listens to this podcast and who wants to say hi. So please, please, please come and see me if you see me.
I'm so jealous. This is going to be so much fun for you. I'm so excited.
I am so excited about this, like genuinely. I've never been to a con before. This is my first experience. I am so excited.
The photos I'm going to see, I want to hear so many stories. We'll need to do like a mini episode of just like, tell me everything. Like we may as well record that and put it out.
For sure. I mean, I also want to record a special. Like I don't quite know yet what it's going to be like. I'm still workshopping that. We're recording this in February, right? So there's still a lot of time.
A little early.
Like that's when you need to start in order to like be able to organize ideas, right? So that's what I'm doing. I already have a couple of photo ops planned, and it really sounds like it's going to be like the Supernatural Women Con. Like I'm going to see all of the women, and I am so excited.
I'm so excited for you. That's amazing.
Yay! But this is also very exciting.
Speaking of like high levels of like adrenaline, this was a hell of a finale.
Right. They needed to wrap everything up and somehow they managed to.
Not even wrap everything up, because I think wrapping everything up was already a tall order, but they managed to wrap up everything and then still kind of like kick us off into like what's to come. Like they've set up next season already in a way where I'm like, it isn't just like a ooh cliffhanger. It's like an ooh cliffhanger, but like there's so many pieces. Like I have so many questions.
So first of all, how about you recap this episode, and then I want to hear all of your questions. All right, I'm going to count you down. 3, 2, 1, bees.
Bees! Oh my god, there's so much going on. We are going to finalize getting this weapon together, so we're going to call Crowley, but then Crowley doesn't show, which is mysterious, and then we find out that Crowley is two-timing them because he was put into the most, like, legalese contract battle ever. Of like wits with Dick, and then he's like, yeah, Dick wants me to double cross you. I might double cross you. Here's my blood. Hopefully it's mine. We'll see. And they are like ready to go. They think they have the weapon. There's no big shebang. It just sort of works. We think, maybe, we have no idea of knowing still. They get there, and then boom, surprise, Ghost Bobby, who's possessing someone, is there. And they go to scoop him out of the whole thing. And then they realize, like, we need to just sort of make this, like, one big go. So not only do they then get this amazing, like, let's go into action mode, they send Meg in, baby, just, like, ready to kick all the ass. And they sneak in the back. And they've convinced Cass to come with them because Cass can apparently see which of the dicks is the real dick, because now we got multi-dicks. There's just dicks everywhere, just all over the place, building full of dicks. And then they eventually do find the real dick, but they also find Kevin, and Kevin's like, hey, there's more evil shit going on. It involves Creamer for some reason. And they find the real dick and they kill him, and Crowley shows up, steals Kevin. Sam's all alone, and then Dean and Cass are in purgatory now, and Dick is dead. Time.
Okay, there you go.
Oh, and like all of that, and I didn't even bring up, we say goodbye to Bobby officially.
There's a lot that happens, and I am just like so impressed that they managed to do it gracefully, because like this could have been a shit show of an episode, and I don't think that it is. I think that they do what they need to do very efficiently.
There aren't many loose ends right now. Like the ones that are like there seem to be intentional. Like we don't know. Like the big questions are, what's up with Sam and what's up Dean and Cass? They're in purgatory. That's clearly going to be their adventure of getting out and what that's going to mean. We have what happened to Kevin. He's with Crowley. Why does Crowley need him? What's the plan there? And how's Kevin going to factor into it? Meg is, to my knowledge, also with Crowley and kidnapped and kind of just away from the seams of it, from what I understand. So we have kind of like all of our players are like, we know the pieces are somewhere, and it's just a matter of how we're going to get them back together. The real big loose end is just Sam alone in his lab. Like, what do I do now?
They've really set it up so that season 8 is going to be another reset from the reset, like somehow, which is going to be interesting to go through.
It's a reset, but the goal of this reset is to let them all kind of make their way back together versus the last one, which was like taking things away from them and seeing what happens. Here, it's like we're doing the opposite almost.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like what you said about like moving everything off of the table. Like it sort of feels like this is a board game and all of the pieces have been like thrown away. And now it's time for it's going to be time in season 8 for the pieces to kind of like find their way back to where they were.
This is like a classic thing when playing, like I play Magic the Gathering. So a classic move is like when one player is like overwhelmingly dominating, the answer is just use something that wipes the entire board. Sure, you're going to suffer a bit too, but you're taking every piece off the table and kind of doing like a tabula rasa fresh start.
It sort of feels like that's what Crowley was doing, frankly.
One of the things I didn't really like know what to expect, and I figured would either be like a Deus Ex type thing or they'd have some explanation, and Crowley kind of covers this, is like, sure, you killed one Leviathan. There's another, I don't know, few hundred thousand maybe out there. We don't know the exact number, but there's a lot from what we understand. Like, I don't think that room where he had the meeting was all of them. There was clearly other ones or like more low level ones, but like they're just out there now. And the idea that Crowley kind of just floats the idea of like, they don't have a boss. They're on their own. Like, sure, they're bad, but like they're not organized anymore per se. So it's like, it's elevated them to like Demon Plus, Demon Pro, Demon Pro Max. Just like upgrading them here. Gold tier demon. They're worse, but they're just demons now. Scarier ones.
This episode was written by Sarah Gamble. This is her last one for Supernatural. She says goodbye to the franchise after this. She is no longer the showrunner. We'll be talking about the next showrunner soon. But for today, we're going to stick with that. The episode was directed by Robert Singer, and it originally aired on May 18th, 2012.
Just as like a send-off to Sarah Gamble, like this was a phenomenal episode. It really did a good job to clean up and wrap up a season. And again, I know these are not like one writer who did the entire thing. They're a production studio, they're a team, there's a writing room, there's production. But like, kudos for a very good episode that you were the writer on.
When we get at some point a chance to talk about like her whole work, I think it'll be an interesting thing to say or to look at, because I think that like Sarah Gamble gave us some like amazing episodes. I question some of her creative choices in terms of show running, but honestly, like I loved Sarah Gamble as a writer.
Yeah.
So obviously, because this is the season finale, we get our long montage, our longtage, if you will, to Carry On Wayward Son, where we are once again promised by Kansas the Band that there will be peace when you are done, and yet the show is done, and I still feel no peace. Close to 4 years later, Kansas, bunch of liars. Kansas lied. Get our tote.
Yes, buy the tote. Remind them how much they lied. I really would love the day where someone like brings that tote to one of their shows, assuming they still play, and like they see that and have to ask the question. I'm sure they must get like destroyed with like references to the show in like their own life. That's something to look into. But like, even like just on a seasonal standpoint, like I don't think a season has ended yet where I have not felt like this is peace. Like every season, even when it, like they beat the bad guy, every season ends with the like, oh no, there's more. Like season 5 was the closest because only we as an audience knew there was like shit going on still. But like even then, that's it. Like Dean thought there was peace, maybe, but like really.
So Crowley and Dick engage in what I can only describe as foreplay as they negotiate the fate of humankind like proper psychopaths.
I also, there's something about like Dick's very minor homophobia in this scene of like refusing to kiss Crowley when Crowley's like kind of up for it, that just like helps paint Dick as like more of a villain than he already was.
We find out that Cass has shown up on Dean's car naked, covered in bees. This is also why people associate Cass with bees, between this and the reference to bees last week, right?
This is one of those things where like, I'm trying to figure out like, are you misunderstanding it or am I misunderstanding it? And that's, I think when he says on my car, he's saying it more as like a, I'm like, like that. Like I'm swearing on my car. Like that's how serious I'm taking this. Like I'm not lying to you. Like on my car, he showed up naked, covered in bees. I don't think he showed up naked, covered in bees physically on the car.
You know, this is actually a debate in the fandom. Dean never refers to his car, to the Impala, without calling her either baby or the Impala. I am firmly team Cass showed up naked on the car, but please feel free to be part of the opposing team.
Despite bringing that up, because I think it's just more of like a weird phrasing thing, the moment he said it prior to this conversation, the image was him on the hood of the car like one of the French girls, a la Titanic. That's forever how I picture him, but like tastefully covered in bees and honey to like censor him for the sake of art. And that fan art must exist out there, and I'm afraid to say I might go look for it later.
It absolutely does. We get Meg telling Dean, go ask him. He was your boyfriend first, talking about Cass, of course, and Dean does not deny.
Because so often we've seen Dean respond negatively to, like, comments like this, but never when it's about Cass. Like, if it was anything about, like, him showing up as, like, effeminate or less manly or queer, there's, like, a, I'm gonna snap back at you. But, like, generally, those have toned down with more recent seasons. And whenever it's involving Cass, it is very much just, like, I'm not touching that because I don't want to have to, like, talk about it versus defend myself.
I do want to highlight that Cass is still wearing the scrubs that he wore at the psych ward with his trench coat like over them, which is probably the most Cass thing that Cass would do.
Full transparency, saw this note while I was taking my notes and I was like, wait, what? And I like literally went back and like went like found a still of him in the episode. I was like, oh shit, he is. And I think it just goes to show that like the trench coat is so iconic with him that like anything around it is just like it may as well not exist.
He could be naked under there for all we care.
But that's it. Like, he could be naked, and unless he was, like, blatantly showing off, I don't think it would click that he's not wearing something underneath it.
Cass calls God Father, and that's notable because it doesn't happen quite often.
Which is interesting. I have some thoughts later about Cass and his relationship to godhood and God in general.
This is the first time that Crowley sees Cass since they opened the door to purgatory in season 6. And Crowley realizes pretty quickly that Cass isn't quite himself when he starts talking about the miracles that insects perform on Earth every day.
There is something about the way Crowley handles this where it's like, everyone's been tiptoeing around the whole like, ooh, something's wrong with Cass thing of just like, he's figuring things out. He needs his space. And Crowley's just like, he's a goner. His brain's a loopy. What did you do to him? Why are you like this?
He's off his rocker.
He's off his rocker. And like Crowley, like, and they pointed out too, Crowley's like pissed by this because he's like, I want like a fair fight. This is unfair.
Yeah, he's like, you know what? I wanted revenge, but this is not revenge. Like, this is just like bullying. And Crowley is many things, but he is not a bully. Sam and Dean burn the flask, thus getting rid of Ghost Bobby. Luckily, we don't see him burning and screaming in agony like other ghosts in the past. It seems like much more of a peaceful departure, thank God.
Until proven otherwise by the show, I'm choosing my own ghost lore here based on empirical evidence that because he was willing to go, it was a peaceful transition versus most ghosts who are like fighting to stay against the burning of whatever their bones or item is. But yeah, bye, Bobby.
We get baby back.
At least that, oh my God. Starting that scene off of just the road, no music, nothing, and just the sound coming in as baby comes bolting down the road.
Yeah, that was really good.
Ugh, I rewound and rewatched it twice.
Dean and Cass managed to bone Dick, which, believe it or not, is not a euphemism.
And you were giving me looks and I said Tower of Dicks, okay?
Dick explodes.
Again. You gave me a look when I said Tower of Dicks.
And when Sam turns around, Dick, Dean, and Cass are just gone.
Again, just like from a visual standpoint, the whole kind of like pulsating and like creepy, like what's going on, like as much as like Sam is very much watching this going like, what the fuck is happening? And Dick is kind of just like grinning and freaked out a bit. It legitimately was a moment of like, I don't know what's about to happen and I want to see like the explosion, or does he implode? Does he just dissolve into dust? I like, but just black, we literally get the opening title screen, black goo explosion.
We find out that Dean and Cass followed Dick in death and are now in purgatory.
I had, like, sitting there going, like, okay, they got, like, knocked out of there, or Cass took Dean because he was afraid he would get injured, but then didn't click Sam because it was too quick, and, like, trying to, like, calculate it, and then just, like, wake up, we're in purgatory, and then even then, Cass vanishes from Dean for a second. It's like, oh, fuck.
They're on a whole different plane of existence at this point.
And I'm very excited for this.
This week, our theme is distress, and distress comes from a Latin word which means to pull apart, to hinder, and it's almost like to unwind to a certain degree or to unravel. So let's go see where this shows up in our characters this week.
Dean is fairly distressed in this episode, and it more or less starts like with Dean's obsession with Dick kind of not being at the forefront anymore. Like, clearly the goal is still there, but it doesn't feel as obsessive as it used to be. But I don't feel like that's the source of his stresses right now. Like, it really feels like he's treating this like any other big bad. Like, yes, this is the thing we have to take care of, but it's not really, like, the thing at the core of his worries, and that it's still Cass. What's bothering him is that Cass, and he knows that Cass isn't 100% good, and that's distracting him.
Oh, for sure. 100%. Like, Cass is definitely Dean's main source of distress in this episode, especially, like, the way that he's acting, because Dean makes it pretty clear that he thinks, like, the whole thing is happening, like, the Leviathan thing is happening because of Cass, and that he should be taking a much more active part in finding solutions. And he says, like, nobody cares that you're broken, Cass. Clean up your mess. And in the first half of the episode, he's more and more annoyed with what I think he sees as, like, a lack of interest from Cass when it comes to, like, stopping Dick. But then Cass tells him a little bit more about how he's feeling, which we'll talk about more when we get to Cass. But immediately Dean is like, oh, okay, I get it now. And he says to him, I'd rather have you cursed or not. And this is the first time since The Man Who Would Be King where Dean and Cass are actually able to level with one another and, like, talk to each other with each other and not at each other.
Cass is doing the thing we always bitch that Dean doesn't do, which is, like, at least speak how you feel. Like, let us know what the issue is. Like, while he's not asking for help or admitting it's a problem, he's at least open enough to say to Dean, this is why I'm feeling this way finally, instead of trying to cover it up, very Dean-like. Oh, yeah, no, we'll talk about it a lot more with Cass, but on top of this, we now have the conclusion to this whole fiasco, and very sadly, on top of all these other endings, one of the endings we have to deal with today is Bobby's, and Dean and Sam have to say goodbye, and of course, like we discussed it a few weeks ago in 719 of Grave Importance, a final goodbye to Bobby was coming sooner or later. Like, that isn't a surprise. But, like, luckily, it's sooner, I guess, is the best way to put that. Like, it happened now while Bobby was able to say, yes, let me go, versus having to be forced away. There's that, like, distress that Dean was feeling, I think Sam as well in this case, at how they were going to have to deal with this and what it might mean. But being able to let him go in a slightly more peaceful manner like this, I think is a matter of removing distress. It's one less wild card on the table. And I think there's also a thing too where I bring this up now talking about Dean, because I think this was harder for Dean than it was for Sam. I know that's saying a lot. We're basically saying literally sending off your father figure. But while Sam always had a father figure in Bobby, he always had a mentor and father-like figure in Dean. This is Dean's only person. And, like, while we know he has Sam, it's different.
I think that there are two things here. Like, the first being that this is now the second time that Dean loses Bobby. So the third time that he loses a father figure. And this is also true for Sam, right? Like you said, because their experience does overlap here. But I think there's also a feeling of, like, this is for the best. Like, as much as it is painful to lose Bobby again, they both know that they just can't keep going, and they can't keep Ghost Bobby around any longer at this point, because he's becoming a danger to them, a danger to others, but also a danger to the memory of human Bobby. And I just don't think that it takes away from any of the suffering that is happening, right? Like, I want to be very clear about that. But I do think that there's a small comfort in an extremely distressing situation.
When someone is on life support and, like, just clearly suffering, they're in pain, there is no getting through this for them. And they, or whatever the situation is, the choice is made to take them off life support to end the suffering. As much as that hurts, there's a level of relief in knowing they're not suffering anymore. You know, they are stopping Bobby from going over to a dark place he can't get out of that could result in deaths of people and himself and them, and at least go on his own terms with his faculties in check.
I think that this is kind of where I stand also especially in terms of, like, having a chance to say goodbye, going on a bit more on your own terms, right? I mean, it would have been, I think, even more painful if he had just been killed by another hunter, let's say, right? Or, like, destroyed by another, or whatever we want to call it. And so I think that in this way, they're able to say goodbye. This is, like, a small, intimate setting where they're able to just, like, to say goodbye, right? Like, it's calm, it's quiet, there's, like, room to grieve after that. And yeah, there you go. A small comfort, very small comfort in a very distressing situation.
It was beautiful, and I cried. Straight up. As for Sam, I think it's easy to see that Sam's suffering in many of the same ways that Dean does, regarding the Leviathans, the final showdown, the double crossing from Crowley, the lack of faith in Cass, the uneasiness inciting with Meg. Like, these are all things that they kind of, like, share throughout the episode. But I really think what it comes down to, and it's kind of really the end when Sam is left literally alone, that he's really put in a position with no supports and no safe place or person to turn to. Like, everyone that, like, you said, it's a reset, but this is literally him being stuck live in the middle of that reset. And that is if distress had an image, it's that. But I will use this time to put my first bet for next season, which is that I'm betting that he will start next season by going to find Jody.
I love this idea of Sam as a wayward girl going to seek refuge with Jody. I can't take you up on that bet because it would be like taking candy from a baby. Again, let's break this up a bit because you talked about Sam being left, like, truly and well on his own, which I think is the way that Crowley says it. And you can see that he's having a panic attack, like, when Crowley leaves and he disappears and he's left all alone. And at that point, like you said, Sam has lost everything. Like, Bobby's gone, Ghost Bobby's gone, Kevin's been kidnapped, Cass is gone, Dean is gone. There's nobody left for Sam to lean on immediately and help him through this, right?
I also just in this moment realized that, like, Sam has not been alone for so bloody long. Because even when he was alone, he had Lucifer in his head. And while that's not a positive thing, it meant he was never alone. And now he doesn't even have that level of, like, someone around, even if it's a fictional in-your-head illusion.
Listen, Drew, I thought about this. And the last time that Sam was alone, ensouled Sam was alone, right? Not soulless. It was in season 5 when him and Dean take, like, a break.
Jesus, really?
And before that, it was when he left to go to Stanford.
God damn.
And, like, we know that the little stint in season 5 doesn't last very long, maybe a couple of days max, but that's it. So, like, and it was a choice also. It was different. So the circumstances were completely different. Like, this is, like, again, this is the first time that Sam is all alone, not by choice.
That's just so crazy to me that it's been that long.
So I suppose we'll be talking about that quite a bit in season 8.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
There's another moment that I do want to bring up, and it's when Sam basically, like, risks his life to go save the housekeeper that Ghost Bobby is possessing. Like, he is so distraught over the fact that this innocent woman could die because of Ghost Bobby's actions that he has to spring into action and get a handle on the situation. And again, I think that shows Sam, like, at his best, I think.
I feel really strange. I feel like this scene was written for Sam. So Dean's actions seem a little bit, like, missing almost. Because in that moment, like, where Sam basically, like, freaks out and goes, it almost feels like Dean is, like, trying to stop him because it's going to ruin what they're doing. And they're just like, let him go and do his thing kind of thing. which seems very weirdly dismissive for Dean, but, like, at the end of the day, like, Sam is so much more there for it. And I think there's a feeling of responsibility. I think there's, Sam's always had this, like, guilt with everything and anything, and I think there's, like, the way he can, like, look back at the situation of, like, well, had we not left the flask, then Bobby wouldn't have gone mad, and then he wouldn't have attacked this housekeeper and stolen her. Like, he feels some level of connection to this as, like, something he could have prevented, and clearly is distressed over not just Bobby going vengeful and doing something stupid, but rather his willingness to allow harm to an innocent. And, like, this for Sam is the moment he realizes that Bobby has gone too far. Like, it's literally standing there being choked out by Bobby that he's had the realization of, like, if Bobby does not, like, turn around and realize his mistake now, we're going to have to put him down.
I'm also going to bring this up here because I forgot to bring it up before, but, like, it's unclear where the spirit of Ghost Bobby is going after this, right? Like, I think you and I have talked about it, and, like, you say that it's not quite clear. So both Sam and Dean, and we as viewers, are experiencing distress here too.
Like, as a viewer right now, with, again, minimal to nearly zero knowledge of what's coming up next, I am fully, like, in the realm of understanding that we are done with Bobby. Like, I would love to hear something that we find out later that, like, oh, yes, when you burn the bones of a ghost, they ultimately do end up in heaven or hell, depending on their life, and being a ghost may or may not affect this. And, like, there might be a chance of, like, meeting Bobby again in some form, way, or whatever. But, like, I am very much in an understanding that, like, once a ghost is gone, it's gone, and that's Bobby's rap on the show.
I think that the kind of distress that Bobby is in, like, is a really tough one to address, because it's the kind that he basically denies, or at least has denied, but, like, for the last few episodes. And we've talked a lot about, like, the second half of the season, about how, like, Ghost Bobby betrays the spirit of Human Bobby, because Human Bobby would never do the things that we've seen Ghost Bobby do. And it pretty much comes to a head in this episode when he's still possessing the housekeeper, like, very much against her will, as we're very clearly reminded. It feels very icky to watch those scenes. And he almost gets him and Sam killed, or at least caught, at Sucrecore. Like, Ghost Bobby is very obviously a liability at this point.
The fact that he doesn't do anything and just immediately goes back and grabs her again was when I realized, like, oh no, Ghost Bobby's gone too far. And luckily, there is enough of the old Bobby in him to still catch himself at that last second and see what he's doing. And, like, what he's turning into. And not only is this self-aware enough for him to stop, but to go to the next logical step and understand that he needs to go before he does anything worse. Like, he was able to see himself on the verge and pull himself far enough back to go, like, no, thank you, Sam. We need to say goodbye now because I am a liability.
He manages to realize that in a moment of lucidity, right? And he tells the brothers that, like, it's time to burn the flask. Like, it's time to say goodbye. And for real this time, right? And for me, like, I think this is where we see Bobby in distress. Like, not just Ghost Bobby, but, like, actual Bobby in distress. Because he says that he bet the farm on not following his Reaper, basically. And he lost that bet, which to me is also, like, a really beautiful and incredibly bittersweet callback to Weekend at Bobby's, where we heard The Gambler by Kenny Rogers, which is honestly one of my favorite songs. I'm so sorry. I'm, like, 95 years old. But just, like, you know, some of the lyrics of that song are, like, you've got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, know when to run. And this is probably, like, the biggest gambling loss that Bobby has ever suffered. And, like, you can tell that he does regret it.
Okay, one, officially, most painful lyrics you have quoted to me on the show. I do feel like some part of Bobby, while giving the clear advice to Sam and Dean to follow your Reaper when your time comes, I'm willing to bet my farm that given the opportunity, he'd fucking do it again. Even with the risk, he ultimately knows he did some good by coming back and was helpful one last time, but just went too far and didn't know when to stop. And I don't blame Bobby, I blame being a ghost on this. He would do it again. And the brothers were not ready to either to put him away or send him away until it was nearly too late and Bobby made the call himself. Like, it wasn't them saying, convincing him to do it. It was him saying, you're right, I have to. You guys need to let me go, and them being on board.
Let's move on to Kevin, because there are so many characters in this freaking episode. We still have Kevin and Cass to talk about. So, first of all, poor Kevin. Like, he is kind of passive in this episode. My poor, poor baby. But he's also very much there. And I mean, we can see the distress that Kevin is in when he sees what's happening to Polly. Like, I'm not sure how much or how little he knows about the poison that the Leviathan are putting in the food until this point. But he puts two and two together pretty quickly. And when he's served a burger, he goes like, oh, I'm a vegan, you know, which we'll find out later that he's not. But he refuses to eat the food he's served because he doesn't want to become as docile as Polly.
I love, like, the subtle little ways they let us know, like, he's in on it or he's smarter than we think. Like, it really, like, it's building him as a really fun character. And I'm hopeful that he'll stick around a bit longer. I may or may not have read some of the episode titles for next season, and his name shows up several times, so I'm going to guess that he stays around a little bit. But, like, his need to help and his willingness to do so is so honorable and courageous. Like, how much distress can you be in that literally one day you are, like, a grade A student about to go to, like, your dream school, and then, like, within 24 hours, you are chosen by God to defend his word, you learn that angels and demons are real, you learn Leviathans are a thing, Leviathans kill some angels out to protect you, your mother gets kidnapped and, like, held at knife point by one of these monsters for you to translate some text, and you, like, learn all of this, and he is not just, he's freaked out, rightfully fucking so, but then he's like, we need to do something. Like, it's not just like, oh, you're here to save me, let's go. It's no, if we leave, shit's gonna get worse, we have to do something here. I'm so, so proud of him.
I mean, honestly, like, he is handling this pretty gracefully, as much as we know for now anyway. And now we don't get to see his reaction to this, but I would also assume that being kidnapped by Crowley is more or at least as terrifying as being kidnapped by the Leviathan. And knowing Kevin's tendency, like, toward anxiety, I'm pretty sure that he's very stressed by all this. And rightfully so. I think I would be pooping my pants myself if I was kidnapped by the King of Hell. Although Crowley's a baby, and I love him.
Crowley has a new plaything in Kevin, and he's going to have so much fun with him.
Yeah, oh my god. So scary.
I think he's really going to see him almost like a pet for a little bit, and I think it's an adorable thing to see. But also, I love this parallel because you made it very clear when we first met Kevin a few episodes ago, and it's now been like a thing I've been tracking, is the similarities between Sam and Kevin. And where did Sam end this episode? Utterly alone. Where is Kevin? Utterly alone. No one he knows around him. No one to turn to. All he has is the King of Hell, who's probably going to convince him that if he, you know, says a word with the letter T in it, he'll burst into flames because that's funny for him.
Poor Kevin. Now, if we can move on to Cass, I feel like his distress has been pretty obvious since he left the psych ward. Like, it's obvious that he's not well and not himself. Although maybe not to you, because you think that he's handling this really well and he seems really well and blah, 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 blah. But, like, I don't know. I see it as distress.
I'm falling for it the way he wants me to.
Wonderful. So, but this in this episode, sorry, he actually puts words on what's going on with him. And he tells that to Dean and by extension to the viewers, like, about the root of all of that. And he says to Dean, actually, if you die, you die heroically. But if I die, I die trying to fix my stupid mistake. And I might not even die. I might be brought back. Like, and it, each time it's worse, right? And I think that what's happening here for Cass is a lack of meaning, right? Like, he can see meaning in dying trying to save humanity, but he doesn't see meaning in dying for Cass, I guess, because he keeps getting brought back. And maybe that's why he tries so hard to find meaning, like, in the bees lately, like the small miracles of daily life. Like, maybe that gives him a sense of purpose. And I think that, like, what lies underneath here and what remains unsaid is that maybe he thought that he deserved to stay dead after opening the door to purgatory.
So I want to, in all of that, reflect on something that really hit me hard this week because I made a connection. And that is his fascination with bugs, not the episode.
I'm not mine. Doing that again. That's my fascination.
That's your weird fascination.
I know. Oh my god. But
I forget which angel exactly it was. I think it was one of the ones earlier on who gets killed, that Cass was partnered with. I can't remember his name now. Uriel, yes. Who compares humans to ants. And I think Cass is reeling from his time in what he perceived as being God when he was filled with Leviathans and eventually failed. So now he wants to work on something smaller and just like watch over insects, not interfering with them, like a god might do with humanity. And he's dealing with his distress by focusing on a smaller and more easily manageable project, one with way lower stakes. And like, I kind of love this. It feels kind of like, again, weirdly, I've done this before, to like reference How I Met Your Mother. I can't remember what the reason is for Ted to do this, but he goes back to his mother's house and like reverts to being like a kid again. So he's like just sitting in his room playing video games, asking his mom to bring him Hot Pockets. And this is kind of like, I feel like Cass's version of that. He's going back to just being like a silent observer, and like they go about their business. I don't interfere. I'm just here to watch over them, and like they do their own thing, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I think this is also very like, if I can't have control over the big things, I'm going to try to have control over the little things, which I know nothing about. So, right? No, not at all. So I think that what Cass is going through, or at least the way that he's going through it, is so incredibly relatable. And I think that that's why we all have like big hearts and a lot of understanding for this difficult time in his life. But there's also another thing that he repeats a few times, and he becomes agitated when he says it. And it's like some variation of like, I don't want to fight and I don't fight anymore. And like, it's just really interesting that the thought of fighting again is obviously very distressing to him.
It revealed to us that this is like related to his cleaning up of messes. He feels like all he's done up until now is make things worse. And it's always been him fighting for someone or something. And like very clearly fighting against something big and evil. He sees fighting the Leviathans as just another chance to face off against a foe. And regardless of the outcome, things getting worse. Like every time he has basically stepped up to the plate, the outcome has always been, something's bad. You know, he wants nothing more than to help, but he just, deep down, he has seen the pattern and he goes like, sure. I show up. I help fight Leviathans. We beat them. I'm just going to make something worse.
Now, I do want to touch on Crowley before we move on, because like his relationship to distress is so different from the other characters this episode. Because Crowley started season 7 extremely distressed, and he's been regaining his footing ever since. And like ever so slowly, right? Slowly but surely. And in this episode, he's the one inflicting distress a lot more than experiencing it. A couple of examples of that is him like kidnapping Kevin, not telling Sam where Dean and Cass are, or telling Sam that he's well and truly on his own, but also being like super shady to Sam and Dean about whether or not it's his blood in that vial. Like he's back in control and he loves it.
This is Crowley in his element, baby! He is loving this suddenly, like, being of, like, in his way. Like, I don't want to say, like, in control, but, like, in a position of superiority. And it's very much him dealing out the distress, and he can enjoy it. As for once, he's not distressed at all. He really is, like, at the top of his game. I mean, he has everything he wants, even Canada.
Yes. Absolutely.
And that's it. That's all they wrote. I closed the journal, and they placed it back among the other dusty books littering the shelves in the office. An entire life collected in some journal and some tapes. Whoever they were, I don't know if this is what they expected. Even with years worth of their notes and life scattered around them like an unfinished puzzle that only they knew the cover image of. A story no one may ever really fully know except the person whose body lies still, motionless, breathless, thoughtless upon their very desk. The pools of blood long since dry to a black reflectionless surface. I have no idea how this occurred, nor who was responsible. I hoped maybe something in here would act as a sort of clue, but it seems my search has come up short. The story may be lost now, save for the perpetrator or whoever they involved. I walk out of the small office, feeling like I've let somebody down. As far as I know, no one knew this person, nor asked about them.
No one aside from me has been here since the killing, and I doubt anyone would be coming. I placed an anonymous call to the police and informed them of the body. I see the lights of the cars come down the road as I sip my coffee in the shop across the road. I assume I've done all I can until I see something peculiar. The officers, after a few minutes, exit the building, load back into their cruiser, and are off, leaving the street as dark as it had been earlier, save for that single streetlight just inside the building. They left empty-handed. I wait, and no other vehicles approach the building. No ambulance, no nothing. My curiosity gets the better of me. I return to the office and find nothing. The place is spotless. No blood, no body, and... huh. The journal's gone.
All right, listen, I spent an entire season not talking about Destiel, so you better bet your butt that I'm going to take this opportunity to talk about it at least this one time, right? Because Dean and Cass both start this episode on different, completely different pages, with Cass saying that he doesn't want to fight and Dean telling Cass that nobody cares that he's broken and to clean up his mess. And now hearing that line brought up something that Sam said back in season 5 in Dark Side of the Moon, which was, I never realized how long you've been cleaning up Dad's messes. So for someone who's in the habit of fixing the problems of the people that he loves, the situation for Dean must have been incredibly triggering. And same for Cass, really, who is used to fighting to prove his loyalty. So they're both in a very like precarious emotional situation that makes it really hard for either of them to listen, right? To have the trust that it needs to listen to one another. But thankfully, they do, and they end up, like, on the path of making up, where Dean says that he'd rather have Cass, cursed or not, and Cass says, I'll go with you. And I just think that it's so nice to finally have them back on good terms, especially since, like, at the end of the episode, they end up stuck in purgatory, like, surrounded by monsters, right? So they're gonna need to stick together.
I really love that it was kind of like their relationship is repaired going into this final battle and subsequently purgatory, because I just think that makes it so much better for me. And I love all of this. Just like, I'm happy they're back together.
I know. I love it too.
This week, we have a message from Brona. Before we listen to it, we want to remind you to send us a 3-minute voicemail. To respond to anything we discussed today, you can use the recording app on your phone and just email us that recording at carryingwayward@gmail.com. We also want to remind you that Mary and I will be answering the question, if you were suddenly alone for 24 hours, no responsibilities or nothing, what would you do with that time? For our Red House supporters on our Impala Talk. Stay to the very end of the episode to hear a short clip.
Hi, Mary and Drew. I love your podcast so much. This isn't a serious voice message or anything, but I just finished listening to your episode on It's a Great Pumpkin, Sam Winchester, and I wanted to talk a little bit about Samhain, or Samhain, as the boys like to call him. I'm an Irish person. I live in Ireland, obviously, and I've grown up learning the Irish language in school. Samhain is actually an Irish word for a Celtic festival we have in autumn. I'd say Drew knows this anyway, but the Irish actually invented Halloween and we brought it over when we immigrated to America during the famine. I don't know why I'm saying we, because I still live here, but a huge portion of our population immigrated. But basically, our word for Halloween night, Iahauna, comes from the word Samhain. It basically means Samhain night or Samhain Eve. So it's a festival, definitely not an evil demon. Anyway, Supernatural uses a lot of Celtic lore and references the Irish language, and it's always very funny. My friends at this point have like a running joke of spotting the Irish when it comes up, mostly in the witch episodes. I think Rowena speaks Irish at some point, or Gaelic, and that was great. She did a good job. Of course she did. I love Ruth Connell. They're not all that bad. Like the Samhain one is a particularly egregious example. And They pronounce it like that in Criminal Minds as well, so I think it might just be an American problem and not Supernatural as a whole. Anyway, personally, I love hearing Irish in Supernatural. It always makes me laugh, and poorly researched and stereotypical as it is, it's nice to see your home referenced, you know? And they gave us Eileen, a Cork woman, so I can't even complain. One time I actually read Irish in a Supernatural fan fiction, and that was the most egregious one, but it was amazing. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm rambling so much. Thank you guys, you're doing such a good job. Like, the by Dean analysis is always so validating, guys. And Mary, I love your voice. It's so comforting. I need to stop talking now. Can I relive? I guess long fall. Mwah.
Brenna, thank you so much. First of all, like, thank you for complimenting my voice because I truly despise it. It's one of those things where I've gotten accustomed to hearing my voice just because I have to listen to this podcast. Like, I'm the last checker, right? So I listen to the whole thing. And so I've gotten used to it, but I definitely don't like it. So honestly, it's very validating to hear that you like it. It's very nice. Thank you. I'm taking that and putting it deep in my heart somewhere. I'm going to say this as somebody who has no real direct ties to an Irish community, especially not from Ireland. I think people assume that a lot of words that come from Irish culture are going to be pronounced the same way that English is. And in English, you know, you see S-A-M-H-A-I-N, you're going to pronounce it Samhain. Whereas Gaelic pronunciation is completely different. And now I know, like Celtic Gaelic, I'm so sorry, I don't know this culture. I think that there is like a complete misunderstanding of the fact that Samhain is supposed to be pronounced a completely different way. When I was younger, my parents had friends who had a daughter and they wanted to name her Siobhan, but they knew that if they used the actual spelling of Siobhan in Montreal, Canada, she would never be called Siobhan. She would have to correct people all the time. And so they wrote it out like phonetically. So in order to make sure that she would be called the way that they wanted her to be called. So I do think that it's a North America thing, not necessarily a Supernatural thing, but I do think that if you're going to make a show about, you know, an episode about a specific culture, you should at the very least look up how certain words are pronounced, just like we did with your name actually before this episode, because we wanted to make sure to get it right. So thank you very much for that. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much for this message. One, to Mary, I get to listen to your voice repeatedly during a week, and I think it's the best part of my week, so thank you.
Ugh.
I've learned to tune myself out sometimes.
See, they're the same for me.
Oh, there are times where I'm editing the show, and I have to, like, I just didn't listen to myself. I have to rewind and listen again.
For me, it's the opposite. Like, I'm like, oh, yes, I said things. That's, yes.
But that's how, I think that's how everyone who edits their own voice does it.
Yeah.
I have such a, like, enjoyment of both Celtic and Gaelic as a language and, like, kind of the mythology and cultures of both Ireland and Scotland, just because I think they have some of the more interesting and unique heritage and mythology. I always find, like, there was a game show I used to follow online, and they would do a thing where it was like, oh, here's a mythical creature, guess where it's from? And every time I was like, that's a really interesting one. It must be either Irish or Scottish, and I was almost always right. And the languages themselves, I had a teacher actually who did her studying with a professor through Ireland and Scotland and came back with tons of great ghost stories and like would list off these like place names I could never spell or pronounce properly because they were all Celtic or Gaelic. And it fueled my love for the culture there. But I also must agree with you, something I do really love is the rare time a piece of media references the place you're from, like this episode with Canada.
Yes, exactly. I was like, yeah!
It's always like a fun little thing. Like even watching the X-Files, someone brought up like going to Toronto or like one of them had like a TELUS bill in one of the episodes and I had a good laugh at that. I'm glad we could share with you our reading of By Dean and seeing him the way he is and allowing us to like let that flourish, because the more and more we get into it, like, I'll be super frank. I think this is a great episode to bring this up. I think this is, like, the last few weeks or so, the last few episodes of the season was really my turning point from Dean being read as queer to just, like, no, he's queer and people are stupid for not seeing it. Like, I don't know why there was always this level of me being, like, well, they're never, like, obvious with it. So I'm just going to like continue with our reading because I like it better. But now I'm very much at the point where it's like, no, if you're not seeing Dean as queer, you're just really not looking.
What's your reflection and call to action on this season finale?
I think it is so important to recognize my limits. I've talked in the past how I can be someone who's a little bit not inspired or can be a little lazy and find it hard to get inspired. But I also know that sometimes when I start a task, I like get guilty if I don't finish it, even if something is actively stopping me from doing said task. So kind of like Bobby with his whole like reaching his limits. Luckily, I have not turned to an evil ghost yet. Knock on wood, that's not happening. Lord knows if I did, you would take care of that for me.
Why are you putting this on me?
I think it's a fair deal. I'd do the same for you.
Thanks.
If I turn into a ghost and get too vengeful, you'll burn whatever it is you need to burn to stop me, right?
Yes, okay.
We're good.
All right.
All that to say, though, I've hit that wall before where I just like, I needed that break and I didn't want to give it to myself. You know what? I have limits. I have to know when to like stop before I make myself sick or hurt myself.
That's fair.
And you, Mary, any calls and reflections this week?
Well, I'm about to sound a lot like Brené Brown, which I have pretty complicated feelings about. But one thing that I'm noticing in this episode is that connection with others, is kind of what seems to be like the antidote to distress in this episode anyway. And that's a great reminder to myself to nurture my relationships.
You've been listening to Carrying Wayward, a Supernatural podcast produced by Rochelle Castellano, hosted by Mary Vigouroux and myself, Drew Shulman. Thank you to everyone supporting us on Ko-fi or Patreon, and an extra thank you to our Bunker supporters, L, Jeremiah Thomas, and Simone.
This week, we'd like to thank Brona for the message. You can go to carryingwayward.com for the links to our merch store and all of our socials.
If you'd like to support us, you can become a patron or a Ko-fi subscriber. You can also leave us a rating on Spotify and a review on Apple Podcasts.
Carry on, our wayward friends. If anything, I would also probably like open a bottle of bubbly because why the heck not if I have to stay home and I have no responsibilities. But yeah, honestly, like nothing incredibly like crazy, I guess. Wait, no, maybe take a bath in the middle of the day. I never get to do that.